The camp had its official whores who were cleared, like all the Vietnamese nationals who worked on the post, through the MP checkpoint. The whores came on each night to ply their trade and leave by midnight. Cliff was caught one night in the hallway of his hooch by a supply clerk from Davenport named Mark. Mark's great moon of a grin pulled Cliff along to the clerk's room. "A little favor," Mark said. "You speak the language. I need you to interpret for me." Mark opened the door to his room and went to the table by his wall locker. "This is Kim," he said. A Vietnamese girl in a bright red miniskirt was sitting on the lower half of the bunk bed. Cliff had seen Kim around, had exchanged a few words in Vietnamese with her on occasion. She smiled up at him and said hello. "I want to make a tape," Mark said, holding up the mic for the cassette recorder on the table. "A tape," Cliff said, "for my wife." Cliff shifted his eyes to a framed photo on the table. The wife, a pretty girl with a lunging gospel smile. "Julie," Mark said, "that's her." "What kind of tape?" "These girls sing so beautifully. I wanted to sing some of the songs onto the tape for Julie." "You want this girl to sing for your wife?" "Yes." Cliff looked at Kim. She was still smiling at him. He tried to visualize her singing to the wife in Davenport, and he failed, and so he sputtered about a bit before saying, "He wants you to sing some songs into the tape recorder." "Sing? What songs?" "Any songs. They're the kind you sing to yourself, I guess. Vietnamese songs. He wants to send the tape back to his wife in the States so she can hear Vietnamese songs." "I can't sing to a machine," she said. And Cliff smiled at her being reluctant over the machine, not the wife. "You'll be able to hear yourself," he said. "All right. She'll do it." "Good," Mark said. And he waved Kim over and gave her the microphone. As she began to sing, one of the Homestead patrol helicopters flew over, rattling the lockers. She stopped singing, and Mark shut off the machine. He rewound the tape, and Kim fretted with the microphone cord. She started singing again before Mark had turned on the machine, but he stopped her with a quick wave of the hand. "Not yet," Cliff said to her. When Mark was ready, he nodded his head. Kim turned to Cliff, and he nodded too. She began to sing. She sang a current popular song about a girl whose boyfriend goes away to Cambodia to fight, and she writes him a letter every day, and he's killed, and she vows never to marry. Kim finished the song, paused only briefly, then began a second song about a girl whose boyfriend goes away to fight in the Highlands, and she writes him a letter every day, and he's blown to pieces but survives, and he's discharged an invalid, and they get married. Kim fussed about, trying to decide on the next song, thoroughly caught up now in the project. Cliff thought of slipping out of the room, but he liked Kim's voice, and instead he climbed to the top bunk and lay down to listen. Kim began to sing an older and more cheerful song about a country marriage betrothal. From where Cliff lay, he could see the top of the door below his feet. While Kim was singing, the door swung open and closed, and Cliff sat up on one elbow. A new girl had entered the room. Cliff had only seen her in the company area a couple of times before. She stood quietly by the lockers, listening until the song was finished. Then Kim chattered an explanation to her about the recording session. Wouldn't she like to sing to Mark's wife, too? She was a beautiful girl, without a trace of makeup, and Cliff watched her closely. She looked at Mark and the picture beside him. "All right," she said, and took the microphone. Mark beamed, and Cliff lay back down to listen. At first, he just listened to her voice. It was deeper than Kim's, and she phrased the simple tune slowly, thoughtfully. Then the words began to sink in. She was making them up, Cliff realized. That's why she sang slowly. Their rhythms were sometimes crude, and they seldom rhymed, but they were a song. A rough-edged song, but she sang. "You've sent your man to make us whores. You've sent him to take our pride," she sang. "You stay at home and are chaste and pure while your man comes to us and makes us soil ourselves. You let him come. You make him take us to bed. You make him use our sorrow and hunger. You smile at us from your picture as he screws us, and we are harmless toys. You are both safe from harm. You both make us whores. The new girl stopped singing. She handed the microphone to Kim. No one spoke. Kim stared at her hands. Mark felt something wrong. Won't you sing another one? He asked. That was a very sad song, I think. The girl didn't answer. We go now, Kim said in English. Very late. You have songs now. Cliff wanted to leave quickly, too. He deflected Mark's thanks for the help, but by the time he got out of the room, the two girls had disappeared. He went to his own room, and for a time, he felt closer to the girl with the deep voice than he did to all the Americans here whom he was supposed to be attached to. But he couldn't approach her. He felt excluded by her bitterness. It never occurred to him to try to sleep with her, though he wanted her very much, he found. And he only saw her a few more times, from a distance, with other GIs, and he would turn away. Then he himself was gone.
I'd like to add that one of the things that you very rarely find in novels about Vietnam is a very intimate relationship between an American and a Vietnamese woman, and Alleys of Eden is one of the few books that really does touch on a relationship like that. I might also add that in Larry Heineman's book there are also some genuine interactions between men and women. At this point, I want to just let John Del Vecchio sort of moderate for a while, since he really has the most historical expertise, it seems, of anyone up here, and is also a fiction writer.
First, I'd like to just read a list of 6 myths about the Vietnam War, about Americans in Vietnam. And then I'd like to read a little bit about, go into depth a little on at least 2 of them. But the 6 myths I'd like to talk about is, first of all, that all American servicemen were racists, that all or a majority of Americans committed atrocities, that Americans were all drug-crazed, that Ho Chi Minh was the kindly father of his country, that the war was primarily a civil war, and finally, that the American military lost the war in Vietnam. I'd like to start out first with Ho Chi Minh. We've been told that Ho Chi Minh was the kindly uncle, the father of his people. Recently, North Vietnamese defectors, boat people who were close to Ho going back to the mid-1940s, have revealed how adept Ho was at using the French to wipe out competing nationalistic factions during the period 1946 to 1954. We are told that in the 40s, Ho believed that the French, having to rebuild in Europe, could never maintain their colonies in Southeast Asia. He saw that their eventual withdrawal would leave a vacuum, which perhaps 10 nationalistic factions were seeking to inherit. Ho covertly assisted the French, helping them kill off his fellow countrymen. After Dien Bien Phu, Ho closed the borders of North Vietnam. Ken Crawford had this to say at the time of Ho's death in 1969. He was so frail, so benign-looking with his chin whiskers and pallor, so enthusiastic a baby kisser when in public. His appearance could not have been more deceptive. He was a sophisticated, ruthless political organizer who was capable of ordering purges comparable with Stalin's. He sacrificed thousands of lives by execution and millions in battle to his dream of uniting North and South Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos under his own communist dictatorship. Whether he was more nationalist than communist is irrelevant. Like Lenin, he believed in jettisoning his nationalistic followers if they rejected his communism. At the time of his takeover of the North, after the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, Ho executed 50,000 fellow countrymen suspected of lack of sympathy with his regime and condemned another 100,000 to forced labor, according to estimates made by the late Bernard Fall, a not unsympathetic ho-biographer. Newsweek magazine reported additional purges. It is documented that North Vietnam, under the tutelage of the benign Uncle Ho, witnessed numerous purges, including the execution of an estimated 50,000 people during the land reform campaign in the late 1950s. For atrocities against their people that pale when held against Ho's record, we condemn Ngo Dinh Diem to assassination and Nguyen Van Thieu to exile, and we justified our actions because those men were corrupt or allowed corruption. And many in this country went further and openly stated that Ho and his followers were the rightful heirs to North and South. On the myth that the U.S. military lost the war in Vietnam, for American servicemen, I feel that this is the most damaging of all of the myths, that the American military, soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen lost the war in Vietnam. The military situation in the mid and late 1960s was one of continually expanding areas of U.S. and Arvin control with a light at the end of the tunnel. The tunnel seemed to collapse with Tet 1968, and our confidence and perspective changed. Yet in areas like the old imperial capital at Hue, where the NVA massacred 6,000 civilians during their month-long occupation in 1968, the NVA incurred the hatred of the local population. The Tet 68 loss, along with the battle for Khe Sanh, the loss in Cambodia in 1970, and the ill-fated 1971 disruption of the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos, set the stage for the period 1969 through 1973. Each month, more and more refugees returned to the land from which they had either fled or been forced. By the end of 1970, 97% of the refugees had been resettled on their own land, and another 2% had been settled in new villages that they agreed to accept. Each month, rice production increased. In areas like the Street Without Joy, resettlement was accomplished through the combined efforts of the villagers, the Arvin, and American forces, particularly U.S. combat engineers. Roads were constructed tying historically isolated and poor villages to central marketplaces. Schools and hospitals were built with soldiers laboring beside villagers Peace Corps style. American medics went beyond the point of simply treating villagers for common skin disease and other tropical maladies. They established complete programs where they trained Vietnamese healthcare workers so that they could carry on after we had left. And the elections on August 30th, 1970, though perhaps not model elections by American standards, might fairly be said to have been model elections by third world standards. There is one major reason for the success of these educational and medical programs, for the increase in rice production and the fishing industry catch, for the booming marketplaces and the refugee resettlement. The population centers were secure. Most of the people of South Vietnam live within a narrow coastal strip. By 1970, almost all the fighting had moved away from these centers and was concentrated in mountainous jungles of I Corps. This, by the way, is the fighting that is described in the 13th Valley. This is the period that I observed firsthand. My feeling is, given our limited objectives in a limited war, American and Allied forces reached those objectives by 1971. From the article in the New York Times by Fox Butterfield that was referred to earlier. After Tet of 68, though most Americans at home had given up on the war, the cumulative weight of American firepower and spending in Vietnam, and I would add, the sacrifice and labor of American troops, dramatically undercut support for the communists. As a result, the United States was probably in a stronger position in Vietnam in 1972, just prior to the Paris Peace Accords, than at any previous point in the war. American combat forces were withdrawn from combat by March 1972, and all American forces were out of Vietnam by January 1973. The 1972 to 1975 situation found Nixon and Watergate obscuring and tainting the Vietnam picture. Watergate became the final blow to our support for the South Vietnamese. Immense pressure for withdrawal of American troops, aid, and moral support, combined with negotiated fiascos and political blunders. We withdrew our forces when the South Vietnamese had just established themselves. In the spring of 1972, the North Vietnamese Army launched a conventional tank-led blitzkrieg across the demilitarized zone, which captured the city of Quang Tri and much of the two northernmost provinces. The ARVN, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, halted the thrust, counterattacked, and regained virtually all lost territory. The NVA offensive was front-page news. The counteroffensive, other than U.S. bombing, slipped to the middle and back of our papers. We then cut our support and left the South Vietnamese to fend for themselves. Our aid to Vietnam in 1973 was 3.5% of the budget for the year 1969. Adjusted for inflation in the wake of the oil embargoes, the 1974 budget equaled 1%. The results of the 1975 NVA assault are well known. Reasons for that success are obliterated by the results. America, sick with Watergate and tired of paying for the war in Vietnam, simply backed out. The loss was entirely political. Saigon fell in April of 1975. Americans put Vietnam and the American veterans of the Vietnam War out of their minds.
At risk of trying to follow a very good act, and also at risk of, I really don't want to turn this into a political discussion, but as I was listening to John, and I hope he won't take offense, I'd simply like to say that during the 13 months that I was in Vietnam as a Marine infantry scout, I know that what I did, tremendous amount of what I did, and a great deal of what those around me did was wrong, tactically wrong, certainly, and probably ethically and morally wrong, and nothing that Ho Chi Minh or the VC or the NVA did can ever change that in my mind.
There were valid reasons for American forces being in Vietnam. To me, the North Vietnamese conquest, the re-education camps, the elimination of any opposition, loyal or otherwise, the closed society, that all very strongly affirms the validity of America's human rights concerns during our involvement in Southeast Asia. The thousands of stories by the boat people, the harsh treatment and the killings, to prevent that, that's why we were there. The fact that much of what we did in Vietnam was corrupt does not negate the altruism of many Americans. At the same time, the altruism does not negate any atrocity or any act of barbarism or our disruption of the economy. Both existed, the good along with the bad.
W.D. Earhart is a poet and prose writer whose most recent book is Vietnam Percussy. He no doubt is familiar to viewers of Vietnam, a TV history, as one of the principal interviewees.
I'd like to read four things that were written over the space of a dozen years. The first one is called The Relative Thing. The title comes from that old phrase, you can always choose your friends, but you can't choose your relatives. I wrote it in October of 72, right about the time that Kissinger was telling us that peace was at hand. And I was, by that time I'd been out of Vietnam for a good 4.5 years. We're the ones you sent to fight a war you didn't know a thing about. It didn't take us long to realize the only land that we controlled was covered by the bottoms of our boots. When the newsmen said that naval ships had shelled the VC staging point, we saw a breastless woman and her stillborn child. We laughed at old men stumbling in the dust in frenzied terror of our 3-ton trucks. We fought outnumbered in Way City while the ARVN soldiers looted bodies in the safety of the rear. The cookies from the wives of Local 104 did not soften our awareness. We have seen the pacified supporters of the Saigon government sitting in their jam-packed cardboard towns, their wasted hands placed limply in their laps, their empty bellies waiting for the rice some district chief has sold for profit to the Viet Cong. We have been democracy on Zippo raids, burning hooches to the ground, driving eager Amtraks through new-sown fields. We are the ones who have to live with the memory that we were the instruments of your pigeon-breasted fantasies. We are inextricable accomplices in this travesty of dreams, but we are not alone.
We are the ones you sent to fight a war you did not know a thing about. Those of us that lived have tried to tell you what went wrong. Now you think you do not have to listen. Just because we will not fit into the uniforms of photographs of you at 21 does not mean you can disown us. We are your sons, America, and you cannot change that. When you awake, we will still be here. This next one is called The Confirmation. It's written for a man named Jerry Gaffney, who was my best friend in Vietnam and whom I went to visit once about 4 years after I had been there, and this poem was written in 1978. Solemn Douglas firs stride slowly down steep hills to drink the waters of the wild Upper Umpqua. In a small clearing in the small carved ravine of a feeder stream, we camp, pitching our tent in the perfect stillness of the shadows of the Klamath Indians. Far off, almost in a dream, the logging trucks growl west down through the mountains toward the mills in Roseburg. I hold the stakes, you hammer, watch the fingers, both laughing. Both recall, in easy conversation, one-man poncho tents rigged side by side in total darkness. Always you and I, in iron heat, in the iron monsoon rains, not like this at all. And yet, though years have passed and we are older by a lifetime, a simple slip of thought, a pause, and here, nothing's changed. For we were never young, it seems, not then, not ever. I couldn't even cry the day you went down screaming, jagged, angry steel embedded in your knee. I knew you would live, and I knew you wouldn't be back. And I was glad and a little jealous. 2 months later, I went down. We all went down eventually. The villages aflame, the long, grim lines of soldiers, flotsam in the vortex of a sinking illusion. Goodbye, Ginny. Goodbye, John Kennedy. Goodbye, Tom Paine and high school history. Though here we are still, you and I. We live our lives now in a kind of awkward silence in the perfect stillness of the shadows of the Klamath Indians. And I am truly happy to be with you again. We stand on the rocks. You point to clear patches between white water where the shadows of sleek fish slip, effortless streaks of energy. I'm clumsy. With an old, eager patience, you teach me how to cast the fly gently so it rides on the surface with the current, far downstream, till the rod bends, springs back, bends again, strike. Your excitement rises above the river like a wild song the Douglas firs bend imperceptibly to hear. Shouts, advice, encouragement, half an hour and a 14-inch rainbow trout panting hard, eyes alive, its tiny heart beating with defiance still unbroken, though I hold the fish helpless in my hands. I throw the fish back in the awkward silence, and you slip your arm around my shoulders gently for a moment, knowing why. Later we eat from cans, the rainbow flashing in the fire, reflecting in our eyes, alive. Familiar gestures, fingers burned by hot tin lids, a mild curse, quiet laughter, swish of a knife blade plunging idly deep into damp earth. You ask, do I remember the little shy flower who always wore a white owl dye? And I smile across the flames as the river tumbles through the darkness toward the sea that laps the shores of Asia. The wind moves through the Douglas firs, and in the perfect stillness of the shadows of the Klamath Indians, we test our bonds and find them, after all these years, still sound, knowing in the awkward silence we will always share something worth clinging to out of the permanent past of stillborn dreams. The ancient implacable wisdom of ignorance shattered forever, a new reverence we were never taught by anyone we believed, a frail hope we gave each other, communion made holy by our shame. You've found religion since then, a wife and 2 children. I write poems you admire. The knee's still stiff like an old high school football wound, and I have trouble hearing. We are both tired, but reluctant to sleep. Both understand we will never see each other again, once is enough. The logging trucks have long since left the mountains in peace. In the perfect stillness, we can almost hear the solemn Douglas firs drinking the waters of the wild upper Umpqua we have come so far to worship. Together now, in this small circle of light, we bow our hearts to the shadows of the Klamath Indians, now and always in our need. This next one was written, well, I don't know, about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago. It's called The Blizzard of 66, and it refers to a big snowstorm right around Christmas of 1966, just before I went to Vietnam. Snow came early here and hard, roads treacherous, wires down. School authorities should have canceled the annual high school Christmas dance. Two couples died on the way home. Tragedy, the local papers declared. But the snow kept falling. Somewhere in a folder in a file is a photograph of me in a uniform, one stripe for PFC, girl in a yellow gown. I took her home through the falling snow, kissed goodnight, and left for Asia. All through that long year, snow fell and fell on the green rice, on gray buffalo, thatched huts, green patrols, and the mounting yellow dead. Randy, class of 65, died in terminal cold in the Mekong Delta. Kenny, class of 66, died in a blizzard of lead in the Central Highlands. I came home with permanent chills, the yellow nameless dead of Asia crammed into my sea bag, and all of us looking for a reason. We never found one. Presidents come and go away like snowdrifts in driveways. Generals come and go. The earth goes on silently turning and turning through its seasons, and the snow keeps falling. Believe it or not, there is life after Vietnam, for those of us who were lucky enough to get back. This is a poem that I think wouldn't have been written had it not been for my Vietnam experience. It was sort of inspired by Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 1 of the United States Constitution, which states in part, "The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes to provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States." This is a poem called Responsibility. The sun taps on the kitchen table, coffee boils. As birds awake in trees beyond the windows, I think of you upstairs. Your naked body curled around a pillow, your gentle face an easy dream of last night's love. It's Friday, summer. Somewhere in another country to the south, government troops are stalking through a nightmare. A naked body in the dusty street behind them sprawls in rubbish, and a woman in a house with the door kicked in pounds fists on empty walls. There the news is always bad. The motives of the soldiers always armed with U.S. weapons, the people always waiting for the sound of boots splintering wood. What if you and I were wrenched from sleep by soldiers and they dragged me out and shot me? Just like that, just the way it happens every day. The years ahead we savor like the rich taste of good imported coffee, vanished in a single bloody hole between the eyes. Would you fix the door and go on living? Or would the soldiers rape and shoot you too? Idle thoughts. Things like that don't happen in America. The sun climbs. The coffee's gone. Time to leave for work. Friday. Payday. Security. Money in my pocket for the weekend. Money for the government. Money for the soldiers of El Salvador. 200 bullets to the box. Thank you very much.
Poet and writer W.D. Earhart.